Not to be confused with William F. Buckley, the doyen of conservative commentators, William Buckley is one of those larger-than-life figures from the 19th century, best known as the convict who absconded and found refuge with an Aboriginal tribe where he spent the next 30 years. When European colonists arrived in Melbourne, Port Phillip Bay, in the 30s, there he was, ready to be an interpreter and intermediary. Now, trying to resolve the inevitable disputes as the two cultures clashed over land and resources. Now, it's an extraordinary tale, and to tell the story, we're joined by Gary Linnell, author of Buckley's Chance. Gary, one of our more experienced journos, a Walkley Award winner, former editor-in-chief of The Bully, editor of the Daily Telegraph, director of News and Current Affairs for the Nine Network, and previously editorial director of Fairfax. Gary, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get stuck into the saga, and it largely emphasises the Antipodean side of Buckley's story, I remember being castigated when I wrote a column a couple of years ago insisting that Buckley's Hope, Buckley's Chance, derived from your Buckley, only to be sternly reprimanded that it ain't necessarily so.
There certainly has been a battle raging among that hardy band of wordsmiths or people who study the history of words called etymologists, and they've been going at it quite vigorously for the last 60 years or so. Now, there was a department store in Victoria
called Buckley's and None.
And certainly there is a part of that saying, you've got Buckley's and none, that may come from that. But there was also a racehorse doing the rounds in Sydney and Melbourne back in the early 1870s called Buckley's Chance. And given its record, I suspect that's exactly what it had on the race course itself. I suspect that a lot of it does come from William Buckley. There is no way of absolutely proving it, but there are mentions here and there. When you go through Trove, through the National Library, and you do a search on Buckley's Chance, you find it cropping up from about 1870 onwards.
Let's make a decision here and now. It's that Buckley.
I fully agree.
Okay, right.
And now, I would.
You grew up around Geelong where Buckley lived. Are they still finding his footprints in local history?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very strange relationship that Geelong has with Buckley. There is Buckley's Falls, which is a beautiful, picturesque series of waterfalls running through the western side of Geelong. There's Buckley's Cave down at Point Lonsdale, which is set among these wind-whipped sandstone caves underneath the lighthouse that guards the entrance and the rip to Port Phillip Bay. And I was growing up, we often heard stories about this so-called wild white man. I came to the view that it was probably a legend that had been created by some tourism official who was trying to attract more people to the region, because we weren't taught about him in school. No one really understood the full story or the import of the man and what he achieved. And early last year, when I had a chance to go and do a book on him and begin the research, I was staggered to keep coming across more and more information, and to discover what a critical role he did play in not just the founding of Melbourne, but also, you know, at a time, here we are having a debate about an Indigenous voice in our national parliament. This man spent 32 years living with the Wadawurrung. He spoke their language fluently. He was written off by the historians of the era as a guileless oaf or a mindless lump of matter. And I suspect that because of these historians of the 19th century, you know, they were always looking for patronage. They were always toadying up to the establishment. He was regarded as a footnote or an asterisk in history rather than the man who actually played an integral role in the establishment of Melbourne.
Before we leave the physicality of Geelong, you think you know the cave he lived in?
Yeah, it's called Buckley's Cave. Now, it's got iron bars in front of it these days, which I suspect is preventing graffiti artists from entering, as well as amorous couples as well on long weekends. It is a cave that's quite large. It's wedged into the sandstone cliffs. And I came across a mention of it in an English botanist who was visiting Victoria in 1853. And he writes a letter back to his wife in England and says, the convict Buckley is said to have stayed in this cave several times. I suspect, I mean, it's the only large cave in that area, and it would make sense that he would have stayed there, particularly just after his escape from the Sorrento establishment in 1803.
Tell us about Buckley's life in the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay, well, let's go back, 1782. We know he was born probably in January or February that year. He was certainly christened by the end of March. He was born in a very tiny village called Martin in Cheshire. This is the land where King Offa reigned back in the 780s, just at a time when the Vikings were about to plunder Britain's coastline. And inside Martin's, there's nothing special about Martin. It's a village of several hundred people, but it used to have the largest oak tree in England, and it was enormous. You'd take 16 people holding hands to surround its girth. 1782, even though the Industrial Revolution is just beginning to work its way into England, you still got people here in this village who believe that if you hang the bark from the tree above your door, you can prevent evil spirits from entering your home, keeps the witch, the local witch at bay, and it also gets rid of warts. So this is the sort of countryside that he is born into. His mother is Elizabeth. She's barely 16, unwed. We don't know who his father is. A few years later, she marries another man and moves to another village and leaves William behind with her parents. So he's raised by Jonathan and Martha Buckley on their 1 acre and 3 roods small vegetable garden. They apprentice him as a bricklayer. He dislikes bricklaying intensely and runs off and joins the Cheshire militia because you get a couple of guineas and suddenly he's rich. And then a year later, he joins the 4th Regiment of Foot, the King's Own. And by the time he's 17, he is in a ship along with 40,000 others leaving the British coastline for the Netherlands. The prince over there has been deposed in a revolution backed by Napoleon. And the English are fretting because they can see what Napoleon is doing over there in France. And they don't like the idea of a people's revolution. So they're pushing back. They go over there, fail spectacularly. There are awful battles. They lose 12,000 men. There's hand-to-hand fighting in the sand dunes, malarial swamps surround them. Anything that could go bad does go bad. Buckley is injured. We're not too sure what his injury was. We suspect it was a musket ball through a hand. He returns to England with the rest of the survivors. And 2 years later, his name crops up in the Sussex Advertiser in 1802 for having stolen 2 small pieces of Irish cloth. Now, back then in England, there were about 250, 260 laws on the books where capital punishment could be invoked. They find him guilty. He's sentenced to hang. And then they commute the sentence to life transportation. So he's put on board a ship called, well, he goes to the prison hulks first in Portsmouth Harbour. Those reeking, filthy, disease-infested former Navy and merchant ships that have been decommissioned. There's such a the prisons in England are full at this time, and so they have to bring these ships in. They line the Thames, they're in Portsmouth Harbour, and they fill them with prisoners. And he's there for about 6 months. Awful conditions, cholera, typhoid, epidemics are regular. And then he's put on the HMS Calcutta, which is being sent to go to Port Phillip in New Holland. They're worried about the French. There's been some French ships seen in Bass Strait, and they're afraid the French are going to establish headquarters down there and then dominate the Pacific.
Now, he continues to misbehave, doesn't he, because he absconds from the convict life.
Indeed, he does.
Heads for the bush.
He shows, in his personality, there's always this sort of push against authority and wanting to be free. He heads off with 4 or 5 other convicts over Christmas in 1803. They make their way out. Some of them turn back. They're fearful of the local Aboriginal clans. They're also starving. I mean, the Australian bush, you know what it's like at night. The Australian bush is quite unique, I think. It makes different noises. It's quite an eerie place, particularly for foreigners. Buckley keeps walking, walks right around Port Phillip Bay, actually discards, we think, an old cooking pot during the escape. And 30 years later or so, it's uncovered by people who are clearing some land just at the founding of Melbourne. He makes his way right around the bay. His final companions leave him, and he determines to get off on his own. We don't know how long he wanders for, weeks, maybe months. He's on the point of starvation. he comes across a mound of earth, a grave, with a spear sticking out of it, and he grabs that spear to use as a, in his words, as a crutch. He's soon seen by three indigenous women who begin beating their chests and pulling at their hair. They think they've seen a ghost. They go back and summon their men who come back. They go through the same procedure. And then they take him back to their camp and they welcome him into Wadawurrung culture. And for the next 32 years, William Buckley is given up for dead by the colonialists. They had settled at Sorrento, but there was no fresh water, so they pulled up stumps and headed down to Van Diemen's Land and founded what is now Hobart Town.
In a way, his story reminds one of Alexander Selkirk.
It's interesting because when he...
We should tell people who Selkirk was.
Alexander Selkirk is the man that many believe Daniel Defoe based his best-selling novel in the 18th century, Robinson Crusoe. And I guess most would-be aspiring writers of the 18th and 19th century wanted to emulate Defoe's work because it became the best-selling novel in the world.
It's arguably the first novel, incidentally. There are many scholars who give it that accolade.
That's correct. Well, Selkirk was a pirate, and he was had an argument with his skipper, and he was left stranded on an uninhabited island, just with goats, just off the coast of what is now Chile. 4 years later, he was picked up by a ship called the Duke, and its captain was Woods Rogers. His crew were all suffering from scurvy. They couldn't believe this man Selkirk, dressed in animal skins. He'd lived on this island on his own for 4 years. He hadn't gone mad. Spiritually, he was incredibly strong. He'd been reading his Bible every night, chasing goats across the craggy outcrops.
You and I find the same thing helps us, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Constant Bible reading.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every night.
Yeah.
But that was the time, and... Yeah, it was used as an instructional manual for many people who could read back then. But it was also criticised, Defoe was criticised a lot for taking money away from Selkirk, who was a bit of a struggler himself. Eventually he was poacher turned gamekeeper, and he joined the Navy and went on to live to the ripe old age of 45 until he died of scurvy as well. But a lot of people saw a similarity between William Buckley and Alexander Selkirk, and in reality, there were no similarities.
Talking to Gary Linnell, holding up to the camera because we're being videoed, Buckley's chance. Of course, Buckley wasn't the only European to be, essentially shipwrecked, owed their lives to Aborigines. Eliza Fraser comes to mind.
Mm. Yeah, Eliza Fraser is one of those great stories. There are another one, James Murrells in Queensland. Nicholas Pagliatea spent 17 years in far north Queensland with local Aboriginal clans, lost all French, lost his mastery of the language. All of them had a very... Eliza Fraser is different, and there is a lot of myth and legends in her story. But there were quite a few, but no other European has ever spent as long immersed in an indigenous culture around the world as William Buckley did. And one of the great shames, probably, is that he was illiterate. He was sent to school by his grandfather for a short time, never learned how to write. He was a man of few words. We're talking about a very large man for his time. He was 6'6". And 6.5 inches.
He's a large man for any time. He's a whopper.
Not in the NBA, probably, but he was huge. And you can imagine what life was probably like for him back then. A foot taller than the average Englishman. He stood out. He was used as a pivot man, as a soldier. So he was a man of few words. When he re-emerged into colonial society after 32 years with the Wadawurrung, he'd lost the English language. And he walked out one cold winter's afternoon in July in 1835, and John Batman's people had left an advance party on the shores of Fort Phillip Bay. And here he was dressed in possum skins and huge long hair and a huge beard with his waddy and his spear. And he sat down cross-legged at their campfire and he wanted to speak to them. But there weren't any words forming in his head because he'd been speaking Wadawurrung for 30 years. It was only when they offered him a piece of bread that he went... Ah, bread. and it suddenly began coming back to him.
Well, you've mentioned Batman in Dispatches, so let's move along to that. Here's someone who I find one of the more odious characters of that era. In fact, I think it's right to say that his name has been taken off the political electorate.
Yeah, there was a political electorate in Melbourne, Batman, that has now been stripped of his name and replaced with the name of an Aboriginal activist, Cooper. Also, his statue was taken down from the centre of the city and it's now in storage gathering dust. There are numerous parks around Melbourne that are in the process of being renamed.
We've got to deal with him because he's responsible, Batman's responsible for the one and only treaty with our Indigenous people, but of course it was a debacle.
Well, it was a hoax, and it was one of the first things that Buckley discovered when he re-emerged from the bush, is that all these servants of Batman were talking about this treaty that they just signed with the Kulin Nation, or what they called the Port Phillip Aboriginals. Now, they'd had a meeting in May 1835. Batman believed that he'd presented them with a treaty, which had been pre-written by a lawyer, Joseph Tice Gellibrand, back in Hobart, who was leading the Port Phillip Association. And it was a set piece, and it guaranteed them 600,000 acres, these new settlers from Van Diemen's Land, because they were running out of room for their cattle and they needed new land. And in return, they'd give them 40 tomahawks and 40 bags of flour every year. And to Batman, this was a massive achievement. And in fact, he got on the boat straight away and went back to the Launceston Hotel, walked in that night after riding on a horse too for 20 kilometres during the night, and said, "I'm the greatest landowner in the world." Now, I think most people accept now that the members of the Kulin Nation who were meeting with him probably thought they were having a welcome to country ceremony and allowing him to walk across their land, which is what would normally happen. Batman, knowing nothing about Aboriginal culture, particularly in Port Phillip, this was a man who had been in part of the roving parties through the Black War in Tasmania in 1829 and had massacred a clan of Aboriginals there.
Yes, he was our first into genocide, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, I would say so. He was also syphilitic. You know, he was dying of syphilis by the mid-1830s. He actually was born in Sydney to a convict father called Bateman, who then dropped the E in the name. And he apparently impregnated a young girl at an orphan's home early on when he was about 17. They demanded compensation. There was an argument over how much money to be paid, and suddenly John was on the next boat down to Van Diemen's Land, where he became quite an adept bushman and a tracker, but he also set about establishing 7,000-acre property at Ben Lomond.
But Buckley isn't too impressed with this. This treaty.
No, he's not. I write in the book that he's an old convict and he can smell a sham from a mile away. He's caught in two worlds, though. His decision to come out and leave the Wadawurrung after 32 years with them, he's by now in his early 50s. He was a young man. He was only 20 when he escaped.
What was the life expectancy then?
You're probably talking mid-50s, 60s, yeah. Nothing more than, say, 60. An old man was certainly in his mid-60s by that stage. And, in fact, the Port Phillip Aboriginal people, everyone was struck by how strong and healthy they were. This is before they arrived and started unloading their bags of sugar and their diseases and their guns. But they were struck by the incredible white teeth, because the only sweet things they would have would be the berries that were growing, or they'd raid a bee's hive high up in a tree for some honey. But they weren't, compared to, say, probably the convicts, the 300 convicts who were on the HMS Calcutta, you would barely have a full set of teeth among them.
I remember Marcia Langton once showing me photographs of Aboriginal warriors who were very big men. We're talking over 6 feet, but that was unusual.
Well, quite a few of the Aboriginal men that Batman believed were tribal chiefs, even though that concept was quite a foreign one to them. The ones that he met, three of them were over 6 foot. They were 6 foot four, right, in some circumstances. So they were taken aback. But typically, when you have colonial society moving into new lands, they're quite dismissive of Aboriginal culture. We'd seen it in the 1840s and 50s. The Sydney Morning Herald wrote an editorial one day, I think about 1841, saying that the Aboriginals have given Have never used the soil or the land here properly, and they've used it as a common. They
didn't understand.
Well, they don't know. They didn't understand. They couldn't see white picket fences. They couldn't see animals grazing. So to them, there was no concept of agriculture. These were people who just roamed the land and ate what food they could find, and they should read Dark Emu, Bruce Pascoe's fantastic book, because. And there are so many other great books now that are appearing that tell us so much about how complex and how rich Aboriginal culture was. And it's interesting, when I was doing the research for this, I had a real problem, because the only two sources that we have about Buckley's time with the Wadawurrung are an interview he gave to the Reverend George Langhorne in 1837, not long after he'd come out. And the other one was a book he published with this fiery Hobart Town editor called John Morgan, who was a bankrupt. Now, by the time those two met in Hobart, both were broke. They both needed money. I mean, William had been treated quite shabbily by the then what was really the Victorian government and the Tasmanian government. He was on a £12 pension. So he allowed Morgan to write his book. And you can, when you read it, and Tim Flannery wrote a marvellous introduction to it quite a few years ago for Text Media, where even though historians agree that a lot of the content is quite near what we could imagine that culture to have been, it's full of battles and wars and fights among so-called savages and cannibalistic practices, and you know, it's written for a colonial audience. And also John Morgan had in his mind that he was the new Daniel Defoe, and he had his Robinson Crusoe here. William would never have even read the book because he couldn't read. So, you know, it's written for that audience, and so you can track through. So I had to, how do I fill an entire substantial part of his life? And there is even very little in the oral tradition of the Wadawurrung people as well about Buckley. Some of it has been lost. So I thought, here is a great opportunity to perhaps also tell the remarkable story of how they arrived here.
You tell the story in very simple prose, and interestingly, you do a Damon Runyon. It's all in the present tense. Mm. Why?
I began writing a traditional non-fiction historical book, and I wrote the first 20,000 words, and I was really uncomfortable with it. It seemed too slow, and also my key character, William Buckley, seemed to be this distant figure. And here he was. He was looking over my shoulder the whole time I was writing it. And he's there now.
I can sense him staring at me. He's actually in the studio.
It's funny, because I often get that sense that he is looking over my shoulder, and I think he's been badly treated by history. And one of the reasons I wanted to do the book was say, we have got this unique fear.
He's nodding.
Of course he would agree, but he's got his agent there with him as well. He's a very funny figure, but we knew so little about him, and I needed to breathe life into him. So I decided, scrap the 20,000 words. Let's get into some present tense, which I feel more comfortable writing in. And also, I'm going to address William through the book. And, you know, it may not be one for the purists.
You've done him proud. Mm. And I bet they're fighting for the film rights as we speak. Gary Linnell, new book, Buckley's Charts, the incredible true story of William Buckley and how he conquered the New World. It's available through Penguin Random House, and we'll put publication details on the LNL homepage. Thanks for coming in, Gary, and thanks for coming in, William.
On behalf of both of us, thank you.